Would you like to be first?
Yes, hello.
Yeah. Thank you very much for a great talk, as always. It's only recently that I've heard Dhamma defined as habit. And it struck me as very different, thinking of Dhamma in a very general way as the results of actions. So, is this a new idea, or is this always been around?
The way that I just explained it.
Can you repeat the question?
Yes.
Well, I hope it's the way that...
let me rephrase that. Is the sense of or meaning of Dhamma restricted to habit, or whether?
No, I think I'm always looking for ways of talking about the Dhamma which can be appreciated by people without that traditional belief in karma as something that passes through life to life, and there's something more immediate and direct and verifiable. So the teaching of karma is multidimensional, is extremely profound. So it's just taking one strand. Maybe it's a strand or one of the dimensions of this multidimensional teaching, which is perhaps immediately obvious and acceptable as a first step for people who have difficulty with the whole concept of karma. Excuse me.
Pass the microphone down.
What advice would you have for someone who's struggling with the decision of whether to go forth or not?
Starting the decision to become a monk. Well, I'd say give it a try. Who knows? As you know, Buddhist monastic order in Thailand doesn't require lifetime vows. And most Thai males, as you know, become monks for shorter periods of time. So I would say for any Buddhist, I would recommend a certain time as a monastic, as a monk or as a nun, in which you leave behind worldly concerns and responsibilities and is able to give yourself wholeheartedly to the practice, study and practice of the Buddhist teachings. And it may be that you have a sense of vocation and it's really something that you realize is what you want to do long term. And it may not be, but I think whether or not you become monastic for 3 months or 3 years or 30 years, it's just a wonderful experience and one that you wouldn't regret. So if you have the opportunity to become a monk for a while, you don't have to, you know, make a sort of a long-term commitment. If it is a more something that you've thought through for a long time, and you know you're really thinking of long term, then in Wat Nanachat where I trained and I trained others, we have quite a long period as a wearing white, and then as a novice, where you can get a real feel for monastic life and what it's what's involved without the burden of the full monastic discipline. And then after a year or so, becoming a monk. And if one gets to that stage, then I would recommend people to make a 5-year commitment or at least a 3-year commitment. Because this, you know, the leaving the monastic order is very easy. It's much easier than becoming it. It's like being born and getting died. It's a lot more difficult getting born than dying. You know, dying can be quite easy. To leave the monkhood All I would have to say is, that's it, I had enough. I don't want to, I'm not a monk anymore. And if I meant that, and you understood that I meant it, that would be it. I would no longer be a monk. There's not any kind of ceremonies and ritual involved at all. So it's so easy, and there's no, there's no taboo against it, and it's no sense of being humiliating, or there's no kind of psychological barriers to disrobing in Thailand anyway. So what that means is you have to be continually recommitting yourself to the life. And that can be very tiring. And if you're not really, shall I stay for another month or not, then, you know, your meditation's going well, and they say, yeah, I'll stay forever. And then you have a bad meditation, or you get malaria, and they say, you've had enough. And your mind can just go up and down, just over whether or not to stay for another period. So I'd recommend people who've got to that stage of becoming a monk after to give it 5 years, or 3 years. It's just like going to university, doing a degree, and that just cuts off that. It's just, yeah, whatever happens, I'm going to just stick with this through thick and thin for the period of time that I've determined. And that would be what I would recommend.
I spent 5 months with a
who would I recommend? I would say a teacher who keeps the Vinaya and you feel some respect and affection for. That's good enough. Yeah, I think this has been the kind of dilemma in the spread of the mindfulness movement throughout the West. People see it so beneficial to people in every walk of life and from every background, and wanting to make it available to as many people as possible. But then, as you say, you have to sort of leave certain things out so that you can be inclusive in that way, and where do you draw the line? So I think really you have to look at what is your purpose in practicing mindfulness. If you're looking for stress relief and just a basic sense of well-being and a little bit more clarity and brightness in your life and feeling a bit happier and so on, then those meditation, those mindfulness techniques, stripped of all the Buddhist extras, if you like, from that point of view, is okay. But if you, from a Buddhist point of view, if you're following a path to liberation, then you need all this. You have to take on the whole package, as it were. So it really depends on what you want from from these teachings, how far you want to go, because there is a certain point where you have to make a choice. I mean, you can't be a Buddhist and a Christian. You can't be a Buddhist and a Jew. You can't be a Buddhist and a Muslim. I mean, some people say, I am these things, but I would argue that you don't really understand what the word Buddhist means if you say that. Becoming a Buddhist, you have to take on certain beliefs, at least as working hypotheses that you seek to gradually put to the test. But these are not completely compatible with teachings of other religions. So if you just want to like cherry pick and take things from Buddhist tradition which are compatible with your previous beliefs to increase the quality of your life and increase your own understanding of your own religion, that's fine, that's a wonderful thing. But if you want to follow the Buddhist path, then there's a certain point where you have to make a decision, you know, which way you're going to go. Yeah. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, if I did.
Can you turn the microphone off?
I just have one simple question. Do you believe in afterlife? What is
your
thinking about?
Yeah. Do you believe in past lives?
Well, I've believed in past lives for so many lives now, so this opens into a larger area. That the main religions in the world, are expressed in terms of beliefs in dogmas. So we can call them belief systems. So I was saying that Buddhism is a different kind of religion. It's like a different family. It's an education system rather than a belief system. But people who have been brought up in belief system religions think that all religions should be resolvable into a set of beliefs. So that if they know you're Buddhist, then I'll say, what do you believe? Oh, you're a Buddhist, you believe in reincarnation. That's kind of like the sort of the highlight belief of Buddhists. But in fact, the Buddhist teaching, which is most relevant here, is one that's called Satchanuraka, which means caring for the truth by not claiming to know things you only believe. Okay? So if a Buddhist is asked about past lives or future lives, the most Buddhist answer is, I don't know. That's the best Buddhist answer. You say, what do you think about Buddhist life? I don't know. But not knowing, I have certain beliefs based upon my experience, my reading, my own practice. So I would suggest that there are many very weighty reasons and logic for believing in past lives, but at the same time to always be reminding yourself that a belief is just a belief. It's not knowledge. And this is one of the things that I feel is a real blind spot in Western culture, in this confusion between belief and knowing. You say, well, I know this. How do you know it? Well, it's in the Bible or it's in the Quran. You say, well, yeah, but how do you? Well, the moment I read it, I just knew it was true. I just knew. But that, for a Buddhist, that's a misuse of the word know. No, you had a strong emotional reaction, and you sort of felt that it was right. But it's not knowing in the same way that we would use that word. So I would say that if we look in the words of the Buddha, the historical words, the Buddha, then they are full of references to past lives and different realms of being, absolutely full of them. And it's impossible to separate those references from the rest of the text or from the rest of the teaching. They're absolutely integral to the teaching of the historical Buddha. So so as a Buddhist, we say, well, I've been practicing Buddhism for a certain period of time, and every single teaching that I have been able to put to the test has proved to be true. So based upon that experience, I have a great deal of trust in the Buddha. So when the Buddha teaches the things which I am as yet unable to prove, I make a decision to trust the Buddha for the time being, because from my experience, he's extremely trustworthy. But it's not knowing. Yeah, it's a reasoned, reasonable gamble. Okay. And then we have the memories of past lives from people who have developed meditation to a very high level. And there are great, you know, memories. People have been recalling past lives in the Buddhist tradition for the past 2,000 more years. Now monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. And so this is another whole area of evidence supporting the hypothesis of past lives. Then there are past lives memories which appear spontaneously, particularly in children between the age of 3 to 5 or 6, which are not restricted to children in Buddhist cultures, but also appear in non-Buddhist cultures where children have not been exposed to the idea of rebirth. And many of these have been recorded, particularly by Professor Ian Stevenson in Virginia, who's now passed away. And there are also people who remember lives through hypnosis. So these are four supports for belief in rebirth: the teachings of the Buddha, memories of past lives that have come through meditation, memories of past lives through spontaneously in children, and memories that have been produced through hypnosis. So I would say that it is a very well-supported hypothesis. And in fact, when people say, well, it's not scientific, I would say, in fact, there are probably more evidence in support of the hypothesis of rebirth than there are of many more widely accepted scientific truths. So if I was to be a little bit more succinct, I would reply to your answer, yes, I do. Try to give a bit more helpful answer to you. Sorry. Yes? Sorry.
Go ahead. Yes, speak up.
How long have you been a Buddhist?
How long have you been a Buddhist?
How many lifetimes?
Yeah, well, just have this lifetime. I guess I first thought of myself as being Buddhist, or identified myself as being Buddhist, when I was 15 or 16. And now I'm 59, so how long is that? That's 43 years.
John, I've been practicing Vipassana Bhavana in the Burmese tradition. I originally was practicing in Ajahn Chah lineage with, you know, shamans and Vipassana. And the teacher that I've been working with really emphasizes only working with shamans at the ground, and we want to get them scattered. I was wondering if you could talk about your perspective on the importance of cultivating the shamans.
Well, I think that this is a huge topic, isn't it? And one they've been discussing and quarreling about for thousands of years. The first point to be made, of course, is in the Eightfold Path, the Buddha describes Samma Samadhi in terms of the four Rupa Jhanas. So I think it's quite clear that that's integral to the path that the Buddha was teaching. And in the suttas, there are so many references to samadhi and jhana. I'm sure you've read these texts yourself. Now, again, for the benefit, I'm sure you've read, understood this, that when this kind of objection was made to the Burmese masters or the Vipassana tradition as it emerged, their reply was that jhanas are necessary, but only for the mind moment preceding stream entry. So this is their way of avoiding the criticism that they're neglecting or they're overlooking fundamental teaching of the Buddha. So this is sort of object of faith for people in that tradition, that you only need jhana for a moment in your lifetime as a Buddhist preceding enlightenment. But I would say that that the path of practice is one which needs a training of the emotions. Now, this is for me is what samatha is. It's a training of the emotions, the training of jitta. It's not simply the calming the mind, but it's all the things that are involved in that and all the qualities that are necessary and the what we might call emotional maturity that's needed to provide a vessel for vipassana. So the Burmese teachers, I think, they don't give that same kind of importance to it. I've been brought up in the Ajahn Chah tradition, and I do see that this overall kind of organic development of all aspects of your life, whether it's your sila and it's dealing wisely and skillfully with unwholesome emotions and systematically cultivating positive emotions, which are all under the umbrella of the training of the heart or samadhi in the threefold training, that they are really important. I think one observation I would make is to really be willing to make a lifetime commitment. You really have to enjoy meditation. You know, that's and without samatha, it's pretty hard to enjoy it. You know, and so you know what's wrong with bhiti and sukha. You know, and so I think it's that which gives you that the interest and the enjoyment and the love and willing to make sacrifices. Well, it's the emotional development that comes through the samatha practices, and there's a whole. And as I say, samatha is a bit kind of narrow. So it's the whole range of whether it's developing metta, loving kindness, and patience, and contentment, and so on and so forth. Those for me, they're all that whole sphere of practice, which feeds into the wisdom practices and insight into the threefold, the three characteristics. So I think that what can often happen is meditators can get to a point with the vipassana, and then it's almost they get to the edge of a cliff, and they suddenly jump back, and they go, "Oh, I was just going to jump off that cliff," you know, and then, but here I am, you know, I'm ten steps backward again, and it's like there's not the that kind of emotional readiness. There's the cognitive, there's the understanding, there's the whole, but there's just something that the heart isn't ready. So I think that for me is one important aspect of samatha, which I value and I think is important to develop.
Mm-hmm.
bottom. Press the bottom until the light comes. Yes. Speak up. Just speak up.
How would I compare forest monasteries and monasteries in the towns and cities? Yeah. Well, from the very early days of Buddhism, there has been this division. You know, there have been monks who, putting all their effort into the training, particularly of meditation and living in the forests and lonely places. And then there have been monks who want to live as monks and they feel strong commitment and we say vocation to be a monk, but they can't, they don't feel ready to live that kind of life, or maybe their health doesn't allow them, or maybe they have a great love of study and a real affinity with study, or they want to be more involved in leading the lay community and the lay people, then they people who would live closer to the towns and the villages. And so their life would be more bound up with the lay Buddhists. But both are very important because in Thailand, you know, if for the last 800-900 years, the only monks have been living in the forest, then Buddhism may well have disappeared from the villages and the towns and the cities. But it's because there have been monks and novices and nuns living close by and teaching and leading the lay community that the Buddhism has remained the religion of Thailand. So, you know, there are different challenges in different things that, you know, are obstacles to practice and to life as a monk. If you're living in the town and city, maybe a lot more worldly things going around you, a lot more distractions, a lot more temptations. So that's why you have to be especially restrained and careful living in the town, city, not to get caught up with the worldly energies and worldly activities. Anything else?
Meditating, have you ever seen
like
weird stuff?
Like,
you never see
before? Oh, you are saying. Yeah, monks are not allowed to talk about their own personal experiences with people who are not monks. I can talk with Jan Bandit, but I can't talk about these things in a public forum. But the practice of, you know, what's really liberating in meditation is not the strange and weird things. You know, they're more likely to lead you off in a dead end. It's looking with fresh eyes at the things that are just normal every day that you take for granted. So it's like a learning to look with fresh eyes at the normal things, rather than to see the strange, unusual things. Yeah.
Can you send the microphone to that?
Okay. Okay, I can say out loud. Yeah. Doing practice and meditation from time to time, I feel sleepy. How can I, you know?
Okay, the question was about feeling sleepy during meditation. So this is a problem everyone goes through at one time or another. And it's one of the five hindrances. And it's quite a complex phenomenon because there are many different reasons why sleepiness and dullness can arise during meditation. Firstly, simply physical reasons, being tired, run down, not resting enough, being jet lagged or something, you know, you're quite likely to experience some sleepiness and drowsiness. So there are some physically conditioned, dull periods in meditation. Another is to do with the way we live our lives, because the one of the things that we learn in meditation and dealing with hindrances is the extent to which they illuminate imbalances and things that will not disappear through application of particular techniques, but will only disappear through making changes in lifestyle. So if you're leading a very over or an overly stimulated life, where you're constantly plugged in, you know, whether it's to your telephone, to social media, to this and that, then that's addictive. You become addicted to a certain level of stimulation in your brain. And so when you come to meditate and you restrict your attention radically just to one thing, the mind can't handle the sudden shift from, you know, incredible, intense, you know, this, that, and the other the whole time. And it switches off. It's like the brain's perceptions are, this is the time to go to sleep, because the only time when there is not this need and desire for stimulation is when you want to go to sleep. So the mind knows, like, activity mode and sleep mode. And so if you withdraw from activity mode, your brain tells you it's sleep time, you see. So that's something that you have to be quite patient with, and also to think about making some changes to your lifestyle if it's a recurrent problem. Another reason for sleepiness is a wrong attitude towards meditation. So if you set up this sort of goal of peace, for instance, but you don't really know what peace is, and you just assume like peace is kind of an absence of disturbing things. So you struggle with hindrances and thoughts and agitation and so on, and then you emerge from that, or it becomes much less. And then the tendency is to feel like you've put all this hard work in, now you can just relax into this peace, this beautiful peace. And that's when your mindfulness is lost and you become sleepy. Because the idea is to be clear and to be aware and awake of what's going on. So it's this quality of wakefulness which is the essence of meditation. So in the first period, you're being wakeful towards the hindrances, and once the hindrances are no object, you're wakeful, aware, mindful, present, clear to the absence of hindrances. But if you think you're working with hindrances and then you can relax into the state of non-hindrance, that's when your mind will become dull and sleepy. So this is a wrong view which conditions. Secondly, it's just very difficult to be mindful, and as the mind becomes calmer, then it becomes that more subtle and difficult a task to be clear and bright moment by moment. And until you've mastered this skill, you're quite likely just to lose mindfulness for a short period and to become dull and sleepy, and then to realize and to reestablish the clarity of mind, and then the mind loses its focus a bit and you reestablish until you develop the skill and ability to sustain that quality of mindfulness, free of drowsiness and dullness. So you need to develop this power of observation, which I spoke about at the beginning of the talk, where you see the particular signs that tend to indicate the onset of drowsiness. So there are some physical signs, some mental signs of shrinking and constriction and dullness, just beginning to appear. And if you can remember those very initial indications that this hindrance is about to appear, then you can cut them off very easily. So before there's this full-blown dullness or sloth and torpor, you know, there are physical mental indications that you can observe and prevent it from taking place in the first place. Okay. Anything else?
You have a microphone somewhere? Bring that up into the front. Keep on that line. Yes, yeah, send the microphone back. Some, but you have to speak up.
Okay. Can you hear me? Okay. I hope this is going to be succinct. I read a lot, in Buddhist life about all these monks and lay people who achieved enlightenment. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. There's all these people that were enlightened through this time. But is enlightenment as possible now as it was then? Even like for someone like me?
Yes. Let's go back to our working hypothesis about past lives. So we can assume that before someone was born in the middle country, in an area in which a fully enlightened Buddha was to appear for the first time in eons, they would have had to accumulate an incredible amount of good karma from past lives. So they were just ready, so many people. So Ajahn Chah said it was just like, you say, well, why did just this word or this sentence, or, you know, how could that possibly have that incredible effect on people? And he said it's like a balloon that's fully inflated and you're just a little pinprick and the balloon will explode. So it's just, there were so many people in the Buddha's time who were just had that readiness because of the accumulation of good karma over many lifetimes. And since that time, I think there's been a gradual lessening of numbers. You know, there's no way that we can, test this. We have no figures and no statistics for it. But as I said, the fundamental object of faith as a Buddhist is that being born as a human being, we bear within us the capacity for enlightenment. And that's true whether we're men or women, Asians, Europeans, Americans, wherever we're from. Just the fact that we have this human body and this human mind means we have within us the capacity for enlightenment. Although it may be more difficult to realize that human potential now than it was, it's still there. It still can be realized. Yeah.
Send the microphone back.
I have a question. That there are many people nowadays that they have mental illnesses, whether it would be depression, hyperactive, stress, and how can we give advice to them how they overcome those feelings that keep repeatedly bring back the old memories that bad for them, that that's not healthy. They're not living with their present time. And many of those I had met, and I didn't know deep enough about Buddhism. Advice, I just tell them to learn more about it and practice with meditation.
Yeah, I mean, meditation in terms of formal meditation, sitting and walking, is not always the best thing for people with mental extreme mental problems. And I often tell a story many, many years ago. First time I went to America, I was invited to go to a town in Massachusetts where there were 20,000 Cambodian refugees, like refugees from the Khmer Rouge, from this most traumatic period in nation history, modern nation history. And the abbot of the monastery was a very well-known meditation master. So I asked him, you know, how do you teach people who traumatize like this? And what meditation technique do you teach? And he said, oh, that meditation, that's going to take some time. Right now I'm just teaching people dana and sila, teaching people to be kind and to be generous and to help each other and to keep precepts, and you have to build up from foundation. So I think this applies with people with mental illnesses, that sometimes just having them sit alone and be with their mind is too much for them, and it's actually not a good thing. Walking meditation, a bit better. Where their eyes are open, it's a bit more natural. But then I would recommend only like the loving-kindness meditation and something bringing out positive emotion. But with people with depression and so on, you know, starting off very basic things, people get out of their room and do something, and get out into nature and exercise, and just physical things are very, very important. But dana is so central, because many of these modern mental problems are bound up with like self-concern, self-obsession, and that just this very simple, timeless way of going beyond obsession with yourself and your problems and your personality and your history and what people have done to you and said to you, and just the to learn to give and to share and to develop some joy through that. I think that's a first step. And also not to be too too optimistic or too ambitious. It's just very little step at a time, just one little step at a time, rather than thinking you have to go a long way. there's talking before something called Kaizen. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It's a kind of a management psychological take. Sounds Japanese, but it's American. But it's very, very good. And the idea is you just start really big projects in something very, very small and simple, and just make an initial step. So an example was someone who had this woman, it's a problem with obesity, very overweight, tried everything to lose weight. And even though she had all kinds of illnesses and she knew she really needed to lose weight, she just couldn't do it. And the psychologist gave her, can you exercise for 30 minutes a day, that's all. And she couldn't do it, and 20 minutes a day. And so the author of this book, he asked, can you exercise for 30 seconds in front of the television once a day? And she said, yes, she could. And that's how you start. You just start with something which is completely unthreatening and easy. Even anybody in 30 seconds, you know. But the point is that you have a change. You've changed from someone, I can't do anything about my condition, to I can do something. It's only very little, but you've changed your basic idea of yourself as someone who's completely hopeless, as to someone who's made just a very, very small start on changing themselves and making some change. So I really like this idea of, you know, because people say, well, there's so much to do, you know, it's just too intimidating. I tried so many times before, but you start, can you do this? You know, if you're a writer, you've got a writer's block, you know, can you write one sentence? You know, you don't have to write a page or even a chapter. Can you write one sentence? Or can you just do one small thing, and then maybe one small thing? And then your idea of who you are is changed. But through that, you are someone who is doing something about it, and then you can build upon that. So this is one idea I think could do.
Very short? Okay.
Last question. So we have been talking about the endurance. Mm. We need to decide when it is wise to keep on endured and when it is wise to give it up. And then always think about this life that we're growing up, where we live. All this is on the platform, on the scene. It's just a role. The end is the same. So what my question is, does it even matter what I'm going through? So why bother to endure or to give up? It's the same thing, no matter what I've been through. It's the same. You want to pass on to the wisdom finally. I'm like, yeah, but what I've been going through, it doesn't matter what this life, what I go through, what I know, well, does it really doesn't matter? Should I give up or should I keep on? Because if you really practice that wisdom or get it,
Yeah, I think there are certain times when being patient is better, and certain times when letting go is not. Let's say in a very world example, in a relationship, two people love each other, after a while they start to quarrel and things not going so well. Then I would say beginning is like, don't let it go so easily. Endure for a while and try to work it out before. So I think in that case, then enduring and letting go are quite different. You know, whether you continue in a marriage or relationship or you give up on it, it's not the same. Dhamma practice is the same. You know, there's certain things that you don't want to do, that you should do, that are good for you, but you don't want to do because they're unpleasant or you're afraid of them. And sometimes you just have to bear with them and do them, even though you don't. And then you come out the other side and you say, well, I could do that. I didn't think I could, but I can. But the problem with letting go is that we're not honest with ourselves. You know, it sounds quite good, letting go, but often letting go is just giving up because we don't have the faith and the commitment, or we don't know how to carry on. But we can call it letting go, and it sounds quite, you know, Dhamma practice. But it means, sometimes it just means giving up. Yeah. You know? So, or sometimes we have aversion to something. Just let it go. It means this, you know, this coming from dislike and aversion. So, it's more this idea. We keep looking, and we become more honest. The more we look at ourselves, the more we understand ourselves, and the less we can lie to ourselves. This is one of the, I think, one of the values or fruits of meditation. We should find it more and more difficult to lie to ourselves, and we realize how much we used to lie to ourselves. So then it would be quite clear. Yeah, sometime, you know, if somebody is treating you badly or trying to hurt you or something, and then, you know, sometimes just be very patient, and then they just get fed up and they give up because they're bored. There's no reaction from you. But if someone says, and then you just run away, and then you say, I just let go of this, but then you never develop any inner strength. You know, it's just more like always going on to the more easy thing. So sometimes endurance is really important. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming and talking with us today. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Doing one small thing at a time is good advice for someone who's been doing a thesis for 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, I just finished a book which took me 20 years.
Yeah.